One, two, three, four, five. Ooh!
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring, and then we talk about writing in life. I'm your host, Michelle Rado. Except today, we're not doing that.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
Every once in a while, I don't have something for you, and so I come up with something else, and that is what is happening today. In thinking about where we last left Daring to Tell with Jen Dupree and her book Slow Motion, one of the things that really resonated with me when she first told me about her book was slow, because I have come to not just love, but to really value what is slow, to value a slow process, to value slow thinking, slow considerations. I even know I talk pretty slow until I don't, but you know, I've been producing audiobooks lately, and there's something about that that really just clicks in my soul about recording someone and then listening again and again and again and making it be the best thing that it can be in the voice of the person who wrote it. And that got me thinking about voices. And that got me to this observation that it's taken me, oh gosh, more than 30 years to come to. And that is, I fall in love with cadences. The older I get, I realize in thinking about our interactions with one another in life, for example, looking at emotional responses we might have with someone, maybe starting with small things like foibles, but moving through annoyances, grievances, into anger and outrage and indignance. It is the cadence in that communication that rises to the surface, in my ear at least, the intonations that live inside of our words. A lot of it, I know, comes from TV shows I have watched and rewatched, where a punchline is delivered with a perfect lilt. Even the word punchline tells you there is a place where the emphasis lands. I think Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David were masters at it, and I feel like so many lines from that show pop into my brain that fit with circumstances that we experience to this day. I'm very tempted to mimic them now, but I am not going to do that. I'm going to restrain myself because Seinfeld isn't really the point. My point today is the rediscovery of someone who I think might have been the person who set my template for loving cadences and rhythms of story. Maybe even set the template or planted the seeds for nearly everything that I am doing and loving to this day. That person is Nicholas Slanimski. Who? Yeah, exactly. In my senior year of college, I was taking a modernist music history independent study with Professor Judith Tick. She wanted to impart to me the practice and joy of primary research. She told me, Michelle, go down to the music room at the Boston Public Library and ask for original source materials about Nicholas Slanimski and the Chamber Orchestra of Boston. She said how this orchestra, under this conductor, was important in that he was the person who had debuted Charles Ives's Three Places in New England. These were essentially my marching orders. She told me nothing more, and I set out on my journey. I can take a very brief aside at this moment to say this was either in 1989 or 1990. There was no Google. There was no internet. There were no computers. I mean, maybe at MIT in giant buzzing rooms, there were some at Northeastern where I tried to take a computer science class once and did horribly, by the way, but certainly not in the places where we lived our everyday lives. So learning and research took some actual digging, and for me, this started literally with footwork. Just finding the music room, or maybe it's the music department at the Boston Public Library, was its own project. The library is huge, and it has an old building that faces Copley Square, but I wasn't even familiar with that entrance, that building at all. I only knew about the big one on Boylston Street, right where the marathon finishes every year. To get to the music room from the Boylston Street entrance, you had to go up to the second floor, around to the left, where you went through a periodical room, maybe down some other well-worn hallway, you know, where the marble floors sort of dip from all the people seeking knowledge over time. Then you entered the old building with its dark stained wood and high ceilings everywhere and no windows. There was a big study room that had tables with those green glass shaded desk lamps, and then through more long hallways until at long last you came into a huge bright room with giant windows facing out into the interior courtyard, which I had never even known existed. This room was inevitably empty, or maybe just a few people here and there, like me, students on assignment. The music librarian, I remember distinctly for her very loud voice. It was so incongruous in the setting of a very empty, quiet library room. It seemed to rattle the windows in its boldness, completely against type, in such a huge and sacred space. My memory is fuzzy as to what I had to do next. I think there was probably some kind of card catalog, but I had to request these original documents, which only could be seen in that room. Maybe some was on microfiche too. I don't remember any of these details. I remember walking there more than actually looking at the documents. Eventually, I got to looking up newspaper articles from the Boston Evening Transcript that reviewed the orchestra. Ironically, for all of its Boston origination, the debut took place at Town Hall in New York, but of course, that's where it all happens. So I was off on my journey, writing up this piece of original research about Nicholas. It was where I learned of other composers that this obscure musician had championed back in the 1920s and 30s. And next, I was curious to hear about some of that music, because I always have thought that reading about music is an exercise in frustration at best, kind of pointless, really. I've always thought it's only effective if you know the music you're reading about. So I set out to get to know some of the music. There were three names that rose to the surface in so much of Slonimsky's work at this time, Charles Ives being the first, followed by Edgar Varèse and Henry Cowell. Ives, I found somewhat academic, prickly, but with moments of great feeling and momentum. And there was indeed a place in that piece, Three Places in New England, that I was researching that I really kind of got into. Edgar Varèse was also a flutist, I'm pretty sure. So I think he had a lot of flute music, but also a lot of percussion. And there was a piece called Ionization that I found interesting because it had been banned from playing on the radio because it contained a siren in it, which was forbidden by the FCC for public safety reasons. A siren is something meant to warn you to get out of the way in an emergency, so you couldn't just go recklessly playing that on the radio. So, of course, anything that got banned got some attention. And at the turn of the century, the prior century, that is, so much of the music and art was about the rapid pace of the changing world. Sleek and shiny architecture was a result of speeding train travel showing up as Art Deco, and scientific advancements of looking into microscopes down and down and down to molecular structures. That was what became represented through the percussion ensemble as well as that siren in Ionization. Henry Cowell's music, though, was my favorite. His Irish heritage inspired lilting, wrong note chord clusters on the piano, and decades before John Cage, he opened up the piano to play on the strings themselves. Really wild stuff, and it had such rhythm and an energy and attitude that I just loved. Why? Who knows? Who can say why we love what we love? But I will say, it was fruit from the same tree that I discovered when taking piano lessons myself in my very early teen years. When I was learning pieces by ear with my teacher, I'd practice songs just a whole note or half note off, creating a dissonant facsimile of the song that I was supposed to be playing. The two I remember most were Hava Nagela and The Entertainer, and the fact that it drove my mother mad was no small part of my motivation, but it wasn't entirely that. I just really liked it. My own twist on something that was supposed to be done one way, but I liked my way. See how it's so hard to talk about music? Anyway, cadences. I will get there. Maybe 4 or 5 years later, after this paper that I did for Judith Tick in my senior year of college, I was working for the famed call letters WGBH in Boston. Not TV, as most people know about, but the radio station. Radio was the quirky original building, if you will, which birthed an empire that came later with people like Julia Child and shows like The Victory Garden and Zoom and Masterpiece Theater and Nova and Frontline and. And I was working for a one-hour nightly show. It was Monday through Thursdays, called Chamberworks. What a little treasure and throwback that show was to a time when music was played live on the radio. That's what we did. 1 hour, 4 nights a week. It was amazing. Even then, I had the presence of mind to know, Michelle, it is not always going to be this good. And boy, was I right. Each night, guests would arrive, string quartets and pianists, chamber ensembles, sometimes world-class musicians touring through Boston, sometimes members of the Boston Symphony, and often musicians who were playing some of the eclectic, esoteric, contemporary stuff that mainstream audiences found, quote, difficult, atonal, bizarre. I might not have always loved it, but I did find it fascinating, and I especially appreciated the background of it, how it came to be, or why. Why was it this way, this prickly sort of way? Another thing I think about in these two sides of the radio presentation coin, if you will, the talk and the music, maybe it was the talk where I found more of the delicious melodic phrasing that most look for from the music in relation to thinking about cadences. We'll put that aside for a moment. Also, in hindsight, I just can't even imagine what would have been a better petri dish for me to grow in than that little show, Chamberworks. I loved the prep. I loved being in the studio. I loved watching engineers set up the microphones. I would lead musicians from the lobby to the studio, from a broad hallway down through the sound lock with soft foam walls and into Studio One with its parquet floor and angled walls and ceiling panels, which ensured no right angles anywhere that would invite sound to bounce around the room. We had large baffles that could also be rolled in to isolate instruments from one another or create a smaller space within the larger studio. Adding reverb was one of the last steps of the sound check. After getting all the microphone placement just right, I got to really know the kind of piano sound I loved best. Close, tight, dry, so that you could almost hear the hammers on the strings themselves, almost. I only liked the tiniest hint of reverb, though I know there was the prevailing taste for a larger room. The engineers would spin through all kinds of options on the reverb box, and you could dial up anything from a sports arena to a cathedral. But the one we nearly always landed on was one that was called Rich Chamber. And they would joke, oh yeah, dial up our good friend Rich, Rich Chamber. I take a little validation, though, that the dry, tight sound is also a sound that the great Glenn Gould seemed to prefer as well, so I feel like I have some cred in my opinion for that. Anyway, it was this immersion in not only all this live music, but so much contemporary music that resurfaced Nicholas in my brain, and those pioneers of the early 20th century music, some of it still as foreign in the late 20th century as it was when it was written. And it hit me. Nicholas had been in his mid-90s when I was doing that paper. Could he still be around? He would be nearing 100. Wouldn't it be great to produce a documentary about him for his 100th birthday? Well, with no internet, I'm not even sure how I ascertained that he was indeed still alive and living a quiet and somewhat obscure life in, I think it was West Hollywood. I also can't tell you how I managed to somehow get in touch with him. Karen Murphy was the woman who was pretty much his primary kind of manager, as well as the person who helped him out in so many of the ways that a nonagenarian may need extra help, including handling these sorts of interview requests and calls and letters from fans. I also can't remember how I pitched and persuaded my station that this would be a great project for me to undertake, but indeed all those things happened because I found myself on a plane to LAX for 2 days of interviewing the 99-year-old Nicholas Slonimsky. I was 26 at the time, and a young 26, I must say. I just can't believe I did all this when I look back at it. My bosses, approving the project, did decide that I needed a little gravitas for such a project and decided to send along Virginia Eskin with me, a professional pianist and lecturer who had a close association with our station. She was a frequent guest on a show called A Note to You and later became the host of that show, too. Much more versed in the depths of music and the music world. I will admit I kind of bristled when I perceived it this supervision, if only to myself, but when we were walking into Nicholas's little bungalow and I sat there trying to engage him about his life, I was very, very relieved to have her there, spurring him on with stories of legendary Russian opera stars and art dealers from Newbury Street from when he had lived in Boston, and even meeting the great Lenny Bernstein. Banter I could hardly participate in, but it was all a great warm-up to get Nicholas's synapses firing as he began reminiscing about the story of his life. And there it is, the story of his life. That is one of the cadences that will forever be a lilt in my synapses. And so this is the story of my life. After I got back to Boston, I had a gargantuan task ahead of me to turn 2 days of banter and reminiscing and half-finished sentences and turn it into a one-hour story about Nicholas. For that task, I was also, wisely, gifted an editor, Connie Blazek, which again, inwardly, I bristled at a little bit before realizing how much she had to offer in terms of helping guide the story and the narrative arc of the production. And even I recall thinking about that line that it was she who had suggested using, and that is the story of my life, as one of the lines at the very beginning to set up the whole tale. That wouldn't have been possible, though, without a transcript. And let me tell you about a transcript. Again, in the days before any kind of automated anything, the idea of an automated transcript, which we now consider essential in any kind of production, was not anywhere on any horizon I ever saw. More like a pipe dream, like imagine if we could have a computer that would write the words we say, let alone cut them. Gosh, now that is even a whole other level, but computers did exist. And so I sat down with my DAT player, short for digital audio tape, and a keyboard in front of me, and began the slow, arduous task of listening, rolling back a little on the tape, listening again, typing some more, until I had however many hours upon hours of the conversation transcribed onto a Word document. If you ever decide to undertake this task yourself, just for the fun of it, you will discover so much. You'll discover people's little crutch phrases they lean on for filler. You'll discover people's tendencies for sentence construction, word choice. You'll end up typing everyone, and it might have actually been anyone. And if you're true to your subject, you'll go back and change it. The other was a very interesting discovery for me, which is how frequently an or an ah are necessary in the telling of a story. The sound of that very non-word does something, both in the telling and the listening. Laughter is another one that does this. It's very tricky because the energy of the sound is big, and to come back in after a laugh, you have to match that same energy. Otherwise, the sound jumps and the ear says, hey, what just happened? You just did something. Where's the flow? What's going on? And there you are, booted out of the very story or tale that had you just a second earlier. And as if all of that is not enough to entice you into giving this a try, I really came to love transcribing interviews because I found it the absolute best way to become deeply and intimately familiar with your subject and what they have said, the words, the story that you are working on. And when you do that, the way that people say things happens in such a way that you think, okay, something's continuing, and now I need something for it to land. This is what I mean when I talk about cadence. It is all about the cadence in addition to the words. And that's how I listen. After spending exponentially more hours with Nicholas and his words after they were recorded into my little DAT tapes, his cadences became burned into my brain. So much so that when thinking about him, and digging through old bins of some of the work that I've done throughout my radio career, I found a cassette copy of that show. And I popped it into a cassette player we had in the back of a drawer. And I could recite so many of his words right alongside him. They came alive. He came alive again now, just as we have passed what would have been his 132nd birthday, April 27th. A man born in Tsarist Russia, moved all over the world, survived on his prodigious talent as a young child playing the piano. He was at once haughty and humble, drawn towards careers that he failed at, like conducting, played around with composing, invented new tonalities, and then reinvented the writing of musical biographical dictionaries. Finally, landing in Los Angeles, where he ended up being invited to play the organ at a Frank Zappa concert, he defied any single musical description. Best of all, for me, he set my auditory template for falling in love with cadences. something that comes into play in my life every single day. Essentially, this documentary that I produced with the help of Virginia Eskin, Connie Blazek, engineer Jane Pippick, and so many others, actually was the earliest incarnation of Daring to Tell, because basically, I read his life story in his book, I went and talked to him about his life, and then produced a show about it. The only difference? It was about music instead of writing. Rediscovering this little cassette clearly sent me back in time, a reminiscent about so much, and so much that has risen again in my own life, talking with writers, listening to them read their books, and then doing the very slow work of producing it into a finished set of cadences in their own unique voices. Kind of mind-blowing. Also mind-blowing was hearing my own voice. When people ask me about my time in radio, I always emphasize how I was on the production end of things. Rarely was I in front of a microphone, and for very good reason. This is another thing where my bosses thought it was best that I was not an on-air person, nor did I have any desire to be, by the way. However, to their credit, with this program, it was decided that it was fair to give me a go at it. Man, what a squeaky little young woman I was. And I really tried to summon my most developed self for it as well. Engineer Jane Pippick was a superstar in coaching me through reading the tracks. So can I do all of this talking about voices and music and Cadence and Nicholas and not share this ancient hissy cassette copy of the 26-year-old Michelle? Well, this is called Daring to Tell, so today I'm going to call it Daring to Play. Oh, and one more little story before I do let it roll. At the end of all the recording, Karen and Nicholas took me out to lunch and then back to my hotel. And as I was in the back seat getting ready to leave, I was thinking how I have no idea what I am going to call this show. I wasn't good at titles. I couldn't imagine what I would call it. So I thought of the most clever idea, or what I thought was so clever. I asked Nicholas, "Nicholas, what would you call a show about your life?" And I used his reply as the title for this show. Nicholas Slanimski, a musician of many faces. Although today, I'd change it up to be Nicholas Slanimski, a musician of many voices.
From WGBH Radio Boston, Nicholas Slanimski, a musician of many faces.
When I was a child, my mother used to call me a genius, and I hated that word genius. I didn't even understand what the word meant in Russian or any other language. But I didn't want to be attached to any kind of little geniuses who wore short pants and they thought they were wonderful, because I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be common.
His accumulated and prodigious 100 years, Nicholas Slanimski has been anything but common. As a pianist, composer, conductor, writer, and lexicographer, he made a unique and lasting contribution to music. The irony was that in not wanting to be a genius, he ended up living up to his own definition of it.
Genius is a person who finds something for the first time that no one else could imagine existed.
Slanimski took delight in imagining the impossible and in making it happen.
Everybody knows about Nicholas Slanimski. He's the world's leading musicologist.
Nobody ever heard of Slanimski. It's a tragedy, because he's just this giant of a figure in our century.
The guy is really a wizard.
He wends his way into your soul. You know, you just, he's so lovable. Lovable.
Because I had several careers. I mean, as pianist, first of all, as a student of my aunt Vengerva, you know, that was my first profession. Then I got into more modern pieces and so forth. And then I met musicians who were interested in doing something completely different. And so this is the story of my life.
The story of Nicholas's life is almost fictional in its variety. As a piano teacher, he taught the Tsar's daughter in pre-revolutionary Russia. He conducted the world premiere of Charles Ives' Three Places in New England. His talents and innovative ideas led him to know everyone from Serge Koussevitzky to Frank Zappa. Yet fame and fortune always seemed to elude him. Join me for the next hour as we explore the contradictions, accomplishments, and genius of Nicholas Slonimsky, a musician of many faces. I'm Michelle Sweet. I visited Nicholas's home in Los Angeles in February of 1994, just a few months before his 100th birthday. Not knowing exactly what to expect, I was prepared for just about anything, but Nicholas was as charming, witty, and full of life as I had hoped. He introduced me to his cat, Grody to the Max, fondly named in honor of Frank Zappa's daughter, Moon Unit.
Oh, there is a genius, Grody to the Max. Grody to the maximum.
He also showed me a picture of the voluptuous Natasha Kinski, the now-famous poster with the python. Nicholas had humorously pasted a picture of his own face over Natasha's. He was very proud of this.
Nicholas is, let's say, an offbeat character, which understates it. But, you know, he's an amazing guy, and I enjoy him a lot.
David Raxon, a longtime friend of Nicholas's, is a Hollywood film composer who himself has lived through a great deal of history. He originally traveled to Los Angeles to work with Charlie Chaplin on the score of Modern Times. Since then, he has composed music for hundreds of films, perhaps the best known being the film score to Laura.
Nicholas is really a very odd person, you know. He has a very strange notion of his own eminence and sometimes seeks to disparage it. You know, you will talk to him and tell him about something which is really wonderful, or he'll tell you about something that's just happened to him which would thrill most men as the climactic point of a lifetime, and Nicholas always puts it down. You know, he makes little of it. I informed him sometime a few years ago that I considered him a virtuoso of spurious modesty, and he loves that sort of thing.
It's hard to say why Nicholas waited until he was 94 to write his autobiography called Perfect Pitch. It's a fascinating book full of incredible experiences, funny stories, and anecdotes. True to his diametric nature, Nicholas considered two very different titles for the book.
The original idea of my book was to publish it under the title of Mistaken Genius or Failed Wunderkind. You know, Wunderkind, of course, is a German expression for a wonder child. You see, and my mother called me a wonder child, but I didn't want to be a wonder child, so I decided to call it Perfect Pitch, meaning something that can be tested with the metronome, with a scientific instrument.
Great expectations surrounded Nicholas's birth in St. Petersburg, Russia, in 1894. His mother had given him the pet name of Newtonchik, a diminutive form of Newton. At the tender age of 6, Nicholas began his schooling accompanied by this genius persona. His mother would tell him that no one can match his talents as a pianist, and no one should even try. From time to time, though, his genius persona was challenged.
My mother introduced me to the class and to the teacher, saying, "You must be careful with my boy, Nicholas." Well, it was called Kolya in Russian, because he's a genius at the piano, and I hated the word genius at the piano, and so you must be very careful not to do anything, not to hurt his fingers, because his fingers are piano fingers. So what happened to that, of course, was predictable. I mean, they all ganged up on me, and I suffered a little difficulty, you know, preserving my precious fingers, you know. Then gradually I hated to be known as a genius of fingers and ears and everything. And then, of course, when I began to study piano seriously, then I saw that it was some kind of an important thing.
Nicholas's earliest training was with his aunt Isabel Vengerova, whose roster of piano students would later include the likes of Samuel Barber, Lucas Foss, and Leonard Bernstein. At 14, he took his entrance exams to the St. Petersburg Conservatory. The jurists included Alexander Glazunov and Maximilian Steinberg, who were notably impressed by Nicholas's innate talents. Utilizing his perfect pitch, he flawlessly named whatever notes were played for him, including difficult chords. The prodigy was accepted at the conservatory and now received formal training from his aunt Vengerova, who was a member of the conservatory faculty. This excellent training served him well, and by his early 20s, he began to teach piano to some rather extraordinary students.
During the first period of the revolution, I had a student, a piano student, who was an illegitimate daughter of the Tsar, believe it or not. I actually met the Tsar's brother, not the Tsar himself, but the Tsar's brother who used to send their amazing equipage, you know, to my little place where I lived, which was not imperial at all.
This was a time of tremendous upheaval in Russia. In order to survive, one needed to have something practical to offer, and fortunately for Nicholas, he did.
At that time, singers and some violinists needed accompanists. I mean, they were important, of course, and there were several to whom I accompanied regularly. But then the situation became impossible even in the Crimea Peninsula because of the Civil War. And the last people who belonged more or less to my own group, they either were disappeared or many of them died of various illnesses or even were executed. And see, and I was 24 years old at that time in the Crimea, and I had to prove that I had proper documents for various groups of people in Russia, and not only in Russia, but in the Ukraine, in the Crimea. But I could play the piano, and therefore I was saved. The revolution practically destroyed all possibilities of organization, music, or any place. But anyway, everybody had to be out, for whether Jewish, Russians, or anything. But you see, we had to get out because, for one thing, because there was nothing to eat. But I had my precious fingers. I could play particularly accompaniments in Constantinople and then later in Bulgaria and still later, finally, in Paris. People somehow survive now. How I survived, I don't know, but I obviously am a survivor.
Nicholas arrived in Paris in 1921 and found a city inundated by Russian immigrants of all classes. Working as an accompanist, he encountered the great Shaliapin and mixed in high society. He recalled attending a party at that time in his autobiography, Perfect Pitch.
One of my most striking memories of Paris comes from a mixed Russian-French party I attended. Among those present was a very tall, middle-aged woman with a rather small head, which looked like an extension of a long, slender neck, continued in an elongated torso, with the whole upper body reposing rather incongruously on a disproportionately large pelvis and fat legs. I asked the hostess who the woman was. "Why, she's Mademoiselle Eiffel," was the reply, "the daughter of the builder of the Eiffel Tower." I was amazed at the genetic resemblance between the woman and the tower, but I withheld comment.
Not only did Nicholas's ability as an accompanist save his life through the Russian Revolution, it also began to build his reputation in Paris.
What I did was I memorized very difficult modern compositions on the piano as an accompanist to a singer who could sing anything, including extremely difficult pieces by Prokofiev and Stravinsky and others, but I could also memorize them, and I could play them by heart, and I did not need the music. That was terrible. I was a terrible show-off, I must say. But I was something extra special, naturally. And then something happened that changed my life. Namely, a man of about looking late 30 or 40 wanted to see me, so I said yes. And he said, "My name is Kusevitsky."
Conductor Serge Kusevitsky had already developed a reputation as an exponent for modern orchestral repertoire in his native Russia. His conducting aspirations were greatly supported by his wealthy wife, Natalie. The Kusevitskys moved to Paris in 1920, where Serge promoted the latest French and Russian compositions. It was there that he offered Nicholas Lenimsky a job.
So I said, "My name is Kusevitsky. You know, I was impressed by your piano playing and by your memorizing and by your ability to maintain the proper tempo. And well, anyway, so I said, I would be glad to see you." So I said, "Can you come to lunch?" He asked me, and he gave me the address of his hotel. He said, "I wonder whether you would accept an invitation to become my regular pianist, and I would pay you 50 francs a week." Now, 50 francs, at that time, it wasn't very big money, but it was money.
In accepting his offer, Nicholas became Kusevitsky's rehearsal pianist. One of the greatest challenges the two undertook together was deciphering Stravinsky's score to The Rite of Spring, a piece that pushed Kusevitsky's conducting abilities at that time to the limit.
There was a difficulty, for instance, in a piece by Stravinsky, Le Sacre du Printemps. You probably know, of course, about that piece. And he conducted it this way, ta-ta-tiraram, ta-ta-ta-ta-ram, making it six instead of five, you see, because Stravinsky wrote it for five, just cutting it short. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ra, ta-ta-ta-ta-ra, ta-ta-ta-ta-ra. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But Kusevitsky added an extra beat because it seemed to him that there was something wrong. He says, ra-ta-ta-ta-ra. So he would stop, and he would call in German, he would call it Luftpause, that is a rest. But it shouldn't be any stop rest. The whole point in Stravinsky's pieces and in many others of modern music that you could stop. But Kusevitsky would do this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
Kusevitsky, for all his abilities, many of which were genuine, really was not a very good conductor. And there were some things where, you know, he could master what was called for in the technique of conducting. You know, it was no problem to him, in which case he did wonderful performances of certain things. But in others, like Le Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring, he really couldn't cut it. And I can understand that, because that's not an easy piece to conduct. And Nicholas's job was to teach him how to do these things, you know. And of course, the old man, Kuzovitsky, resented it being known generally. It was indiscreet to do that, you know. But as somebody once said, who is Nicholas to be discreet?
Kuzovitsky belonged to the past, and he was great in conducting regular music, but he couldn't manage Stravinsky, Prokofiev, or any of them.
In 1923, Nicholas received a job offer in Rochester, New York, at the Eastman School of Music as opera coach for their American Opera Company. It was there, under the tutelage of Albert Coates, that he first tasted the joys and trials of conducting. Nicholas also tried his hand at composition, writing a series of songs that might have been the first endeavor to set advertising copy to music. He called them his advertising songs. They're a good example of Nicholas's tongue-in-cheek humor. Nicholas's experience with Kuzovitsky was not yet finished. Kuzovitsky himself immigrated to the U.S. in 1924 to become music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. The following spring, Kuzovitsky invited Nicholas to Boston to serve again as his rehearsal pianist and also as personal secretary. As a recent emigre, Kuzovitsky relied heavily on Nicholas as both a musical and cultural translator. He utilized him so much that a kind of scandal began to develop in Boston's musical circles. Many people question how much of Kuzovitsky's reputation was built on his own abilities as a conductor and how much was owed to Nicholas's talents. Despite Nicholas's intention to try and dispel the rumors, ambiguities about their musical relationship began to grow. One occasion in particular illustrated this so perfectly that it startled Nicholas.
I introduced myself to this publisher, and I said, well, I would like to have some job, you know, to do something around. You see, by that time, I had enough English to be able to write articles and so forth. So the manager said, Nicholas Stravinsky, I know your name. You are the person who teaches Stravinsky how to conduct. And I said to myself, my God, I mean, I never said anything like that. But you see what happened, that Kuzovitsky was telling everybody how wonderful I am. By that time, I was 34.
Kuzovitsky constantly praised Nicholas for the skills that he himself lacked. This set up a very uncomfortable situation between them, in which Nicholas felt pressure to live up to the expectations created by Kuzovitsky. Nicholas recalled this in his book.
Kuzovitsky had a most disagreeable habit of diluting his praise with mockery. You who know everything, You who hear everything, you who remember everything, will you tell me if there was anything wrong in rehearsal? I usually replied that it was he, Kusevitsky, who attributed these qualities to me, and that I never made claims to any such omniscience. But I must admit I took advantage of every opportunity to prove him right. Despite the dangers, I continued to irritate Kusevitsky, not so much by correcting errors in the music as by my lack of tact in announcing them.
The situation worsened with an article that appeared in the New York Times.
I remember it until this day. Wrong rumors about Kusevitsky's inability to learn proper terminology of music. I mean, this is just the most terrible thing to say. And it was my fault, really, because I said that I probably allowed Kusevitsky to tell everybody how wonderful I was. And that was a mistake.
The situation collapsed completely in early 1927. That spring, Mrs. Kusevitsky handed Nicholas Slonimsky his final check. Nicholas would never again see his former boss, Serge Kusevitsky, face to face. Nicholas had reached the first of many turning points in his life. He had always been attracted to modern music and the challenges it presented, but now he decided to truly dedicate himself to its cause. He founded the Chamber Orchestra of Boston in 1927 with a membership drawn from players in the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Its purpose? To perform orchestral chamber music of American composers not heard elsewhere. Nicholas championed composers such as Henry Cowell, Edgar Varèse, and Charles Ives, all unknowns at that time. For all of his enthusiasm, Nicholas realized he still had quite a bit to learn when it came to conducting.
It was not successful. In fact, the reviews were pretty terrible, saying that I conducted those modern pieces, but that I didn't possess the proper technique and so forth, which unfortunately was true. I was not ready as a conductor in 1927, that far back, and I couldn't even do old-fashioned pieces.
Regardless of bad reviews, Nicholas continued to promote modern music. He was drawn to the small but extraordinary group of individuals who shared his interest in forging new territory in music. A new friendship with a composer named Henry Cowell developed. Cowell, a daring experimentalist, was the first composer to open up the piano and actually play on the strings themselves. He was insightful enough to create the New Music Quarterly, a publishing company that provided a venue for new composers unable to get their works printed elsewhere. One of Nicholas's own works appeared in the publication, a suite for piano called Studies in Black and White, in which the right hand plays on the white keys and the left hand plays on the black keys. Virginia Eskin, professor of piano at Northeastern University in Boston, has played the Studies in Black and White on a number of occasions.
Slonimsky has a unique brain. He has a unique eye and ear brain, but particularly the eye brain, because if you look at his music long before you play it, you better understand it. You have to analyze it visually. That doesn't happen in most music. You have to have the trick. What is the trick of it?
In 1928, Henry Cowell introduced Slonimsky to another American composer who also struggled to have his music performed publicly.
I had lunch with Charles Ives, Edward Henry Cowell, in Charles Ives' apartment in New York. And Charles Ives, by that time, could no longer write well because he had a heart condition. And so he said that nobody could conduct his music because it was difficult and so forth. But, I mean, anything that was difficult and unusual and so forth, he had an extra attraction for me. But I was interested in Charles Ives and Henry Cowell and Edgar Varese and various other people just because they did something that no one would touch, not even Koussevitzky, not even people like Koussevitzky.
Went out of his way to make a special arrangement of three places in New England for chamber orchestra so that Nicholas could perform it with the Chamber Orchestra of Boston. This would be the last score Ives wrote out in his own hand due to his failing health. Slonimsky premiered the work on January 10, 1931 at Town Hall in New York. By now, Nicholas's capacity as a conductor had really grown. He became famous for his ambidextrous conducting abilities, in which he could conduct 1 meter with his left hand and another meter with his right.
I established myself as a person who could conduct anything, and particularly several pieces at the same time, like 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, simultaneously 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. So all of a sudden, or maybe not all of a sudden, maybe deliberately, I became a spokesman for modern music.
'31 was a momentous year for Nicholas. He traveled to Paris under Charles Ives' auspices, performing three places in New England and other American works, receiving positive reviews. It was also a significant year for him personally. He received his American citizenship on April 27th, his 37th birthday. He wed an American, Dorothy Adlow, in Paris on July 30th. Composer Edgar Varese served as the best man. No sooner had Nicholas returned to the U.S. when he again traveled to Europe, building on his well-known European reputation as an ambassador of both little-known international and American music.
The conducting program that I arranged in Paris was so unusual that I got terrific reviews. And I also conducted Cuban music. They never heard that there was such a thing as Cuban music, but I conducted that, and I conducted some other Latin American music. I made the trip to Latin America. And then after that, I repeated the program in Berlin. In other words, I established myself as a non-such person, you know, who would do anything for modern music.
With his success as a conductor, Nicholas returned home to America. He made his first appearance with a major American orchestra in December of 1932 with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. The program again included Ives' three places in New England, as well as music of Mozart, Sibelius, Mussorgsky, and Roy Harris. The reviews were glowing, with one going so far as to say, "We need more conductors like Nicholas Slonimsky, more men of his imagination, his suppleness, his vivacity, his musicianship, and what is even more important, his courage." The impact of Nicholas's innovative programming is felt by conductors even today.
Well, there's no question that he introduced an amount of repertoire to the general public, in particular Ives, of course.
Conductor Leonard Slatkin is music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra.
I don't think anybody thinks about him much today in terms of his contribution as an actual conductor, meaning you don't think about him as a leading interpreter of any specific school of music. What you think about him is his pioneering efforts and championing of composers who at certain times in their lives just didn't have the background and qualifications seemed to put them in the public's mind. It was indeed Slonimsky that did that.
With his successful debut with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Nicholas was finding a way to bring new life into the bastions of classical music. He continued to premiere some of the most modern works of the time, including a daring score by a French composer.
Ionization was supposed to represent a new development in atomic fission, which didn't even exist at that time, you know, but Varese, who was a student of electronics and so forth, he introduced the idea of ionization, that is, the division of ions, of the little elements of modern music, and he dedicated this piece to me. I gave it first performance. I played the first record of Ionization. This is very important, the music of Varese. The New York Philharmonic musicians could not play those difficult rhythms, you see, because it was something that they never knew, and it had to be 1932, before Hitler.
Ionization was Nicholas Slonimsky's first recording contract. The ensemble put together for its premiere turned out to be a star-studded cast, including Carlos Salcedo, Wallingford Rieger, Henry Cowell, the young William Schumann, and the composer himself, Edgar Varese, playing the sirens. Nicholas then received yet another offer that seemed destined to raise his prestige even more. It was to conduct an 8-week season at the Hollywood Bowl in the summer of 1933. Because of his successful experience with the Los Angeles musicians, he was heartily endorsed to the Hollywood Bowl management. The ensuing events, however, were more complex than Nicholas might have imagined. They were significant enough to warrant a separate chapter in his autobiography, Perfect Pitch.
Alfred Hertz, the bearded German patriarch who had originated the Hollywood Bowl concert series in 1922, came to my rehearsal of Ionization and watched me trying to explain asymmetrical rhythms to bewildered drummers. Getting no satisfaction, I beat the rhythm out on a drum myself. Hertz asked me after the rehearsal whether I was a professional drummer, and seemed surprised when I told him that I had never beaten a drum before in my life.
The venture was disastrous. The reviews were sour, with many disgruntled listeners writing letters to the Los Angeles Times. In a radio broadcast many years later, Nicholas recalled this debacle with his usual good humor.
The Hollywood Bowl was the scene of a scandal created by musicologist, composer, and conductor Nicholas Slonimsky.
What I did, I merely produced an irritant. And I remember old man Alfred Hertz, the father of the Hollywood Bowl, apparently the rumors reached him that I was doing something wild. And so he came to one of my rehearsals. And there I was conducting Ionization. And it's only for percussion instruments and two sirens. You know, imagine they hearing such sounds. There were all those old ladies, and they were really old ladies, because when I conducted there in the summer of 1933, you know, there were some ladies who were born in 1840, you know, so they were really old, you know, and to them it was just an assault, an really? Insult. Much later I found out that after I left Los Angeles, this polemic was going on still, on the pages of the Los Angeles Times, mostly against me. But there was a little group of people, you know, Henry Cowell was here, and then numerous other people, and some some old-fashioned musicians who were interested enough to come and to listen to something new, and they were for me.
One of the letters Nicholas received was typical of the vehemence that listeners felt towards Varese's work.
A postcard received by Nicholas Slonimsky after his performance of Varese's Ionization at the Hollywood Bowl, July 16, 1933. Dear Mr. Slonimsky, after hearing Varese's Ionization, I am anxious that you should examine my composition scored for two stoves and a kitchen sink. I've named it Concussion Symphony, descriptive of the disintegration of an Irish potato under the influence of a powerful atomizer. Signed, Iona Lotta Bunk.
In spite of the magnitude of the disaster, there was at least one person in the audience who approved of the program. The young John Cage.
It was in the Hollywood Bowl, 1930-something. We were at a great distance from each other. You had gotten composers from all over the world, each one to write a fanfare. You were the conductor of the orchestra. I was in the audience, your willing and enthusiastic recipient. It was two memorable weeks. I'll never forget those concerts.
Unfortunately, Cage's sentiments were not enough to change the course of events. Nicholas Slonimsky's conducting career came to a crashing halt. His life's greatest aspiration had come to an end.
My hope was that I was going to be a real conductor because I could conduct two against three and five against I don't know what. And people like Charles Ives and Edgar Varese and Henry Cowell all praised me as the only conductor who could do their works because Koussevitzky and others could not do that. Koussevitzky could not even conduct three changing to, but it didn't work. It didn't work. I could conduct all kinds of things, but I lacked apparently a relationship with the orchestra, or now, of course, anything goes. People conduct modern music without apologies.
Once again, Leonard Slatkin.
When Slonimsky was there, he was developing new techniques because the music presented problems and the solutions that needed to be found had to be innovative. They really had to be things that nobody had thought of before. I think that's one reason for his success, or what I deem his success. He didn't seem that successful while he was active as a conductor, but on the other hand, these days, in retrospect, we can look on him as being pioneering and progressive. In other words, the expansion of the repertoire, the idea that the repertoire was enlarged because of what he did, that's the main contribution he left for all of us. And there are few people today that I can say the same thing of.
Although sporadic, Nicholas continued to receive occasional conducting engagements and to work with Ives, Cowell, and Varese. In his quest to find a new direction for his voracious intellect and talents, his life took yet another turn. He had written children's articles about music for the Christian Science Monitor, but now turned more seriously to writing. He published his first book in 1937, entitled Music Since 1900, a day-by-day account of significant musical events of the 20th century.
I was interested to expand my field into that and also into mathematics. Anyway, I just wanted to do something totally different. And partly I achieved it, particularly because of the success of my books, Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns.
The Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns was published in 1947. As with most things Nicholas had achieved, it was unlike anything anyone had done before, and its initial success was hard to gauge.
It didn't sell at all, and everybody told me that I was wasting my effort promoting something that could not possibly be successful among others. And then, lo and behold, what happened? It became successful among jazz players and rock and roll players.
Of the many jazz musicians who used the thesaurus, John Coltrane was one of the best known. David Raxon.
It's an amazing achievement, and it's exactly the kind of thing that that incredible mind of his would do. You know, there are not many other people who would think of a thing like that, let alone accomplish it.
I realized that there were combinations of sounds and rhythms that could be put together and then create new type of harmony, new type of melody, a new type of rhythm. It was endorsed, of course, by Henry Cowell and by Charles Ives and by Varese and by particularly Schoenberg found that this book was of interest. But he added in his endorsement of my book, he added a phrase that sounded as if it was expressing doubt. He said, "But I am a composer and I must follow my inspiration." This is what Schoenberg said about my scales. Now, it's a sort of a bestseller. I don't want to say that anything I did was so successful, but the fact remains that I promoted something that nobody would touch. Even the publishers would not touch it. But then I said to myself, I've got to do that just because nobody else would do it. So in a way I said, well, I wasn't so dumb after all.
Once again, David Raxon.
Remember, I too appreciate very greatly what that man was able to do. It's absolutely unique. There is nobody else in the history of music that I know of who did that. None, of course, being the editor of Baker's Dictionary of Musical Biography, Music Since 1900, and his autobiography, which was originally supposed to be called A Failed Wunderkind, you know, which is a little self-disparagement, ironic, and now is called Perfect Pitch, and also A Lexicon of Musical Invective.
The Lexicon of Musical Invective is Nicholas's Dictionary of Musical Criticism that was published in 1953. Like many of his other projects, it proves that history can be both educational and amusing, because truth is always stranger than fiction. At least it is for someone like Nicholas.
You just have to look up that book, Lexicon of Musical Invective, because it has become, in a way, celebrated. I mean, celebrated in reverse. It's a, can you believe that critics actually wrote that Beethoven couldn't write melodious music because he couldn't hear, because he was half deaf. In fact, he was deaf, almost.
A. U. Libichev, Beethoven, His Critics and Admirers, Paris, 1857. Beethoven took a liking to uneuphonious dissonances because his hearing was limited and confused. Accumulations of notes of the most monstrous kind sounded in his head as acceptable and well-balanced combinations. Musical World, London, October 28, 1841. The entire works of Chopin present a motley surface of ranting hyperbole and excruciating cacophony. When he is not thus singular, he is no better than Strauss or any other waltz compounder.
It's true that many of the entries in the book seem quite ridiculous in retrospect, which was probably Nicholas's point all along. Slonimsky himself had experienced the reactionary wrath of many a fast-tongued critic in his time. Perhaps because of this, he seemed driven to gather together these criticisms that would otherwise have gone unnoticed in library archives.
Well, I found them You would be surprised. In the Boston Public Library, in the actual criticisms of various composers and musicians and professional critics who wrote about a great man like Beethoven or Chopin, before knowing who Chopin and or Beethoven were, you see. And then I collected it, and people began to read it, said, I don't believe that anybody could say such nonsense.
La Revue du Temps Présent, Paris, 1910. The lovers, Pelléas and Mélisande, of Monsieur Debussy seem tired from birth. These plaintive bleatings, these jeremiads, these perpetual lamentations give me physical pain. The love of Pelléas produces the impression of a treatise on neurasthenia and impotence.
Particularly, of course, I emphasized the nonsense that was written about modern composers, as beginning with Debussy, not with Varese, because modern music was really started in a way by Debussy. Well, that's a long story. Then going to Stravinsky, the terrible things they said about Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, which has become a popular masterpiece in modern music.
Pierre Lalot, Paris, June 3, 1913. The most essential characteristic of Le Sacre du Printemps is that it is the most dissonant and the most discordant composition yet written. Never was the system and the cult of the wrong note practiced with so much industry, zeal, and fury. From the first measure to the last, whatever note one expects, it is never the one that comes, but one on the side, which should not come. Whatever is suggested by a preceding chord, it is another chord that is heard. And this chord and this note are used deliberately to produce the impression of acute and almost cruel discord. When two themes are superposed, far be it from the composer's mind to use themes that fit together. Quite to the contrary, he chooses such themes that their superposition should produce the most irritating friction and gnashing that can be imagined.
And then, of course, going to Varese and others, you know, is an extraordinary condemnation.
W.J. Henderson, New York Herald, March 5, 1923. It remained for Edgar Varese, to whom all honor, to shatter the calm of a Sabbath night, to cause peaceful lovers of music to scream out their agony, to arouse angry emotions and tempt men to retire to the back of the theater and perform tympanal concertos on each other's faces. This is a big triumph.
One of the critics even realized that he wrote something terrible about Prokofiev, that Prokofiev didn't know how to compose, that Prokofiev wrote terrible nonsense. And see, but that would take me another hour to say how critics finally realized that they were deadly wrong.
H. E. Krebil, New York Tribune, December 12, 1918. Mr. Prokofiev's pieces have been contributions not to the art of music, but to national pathology and pharmacopoeia. As such, they were distinctly unwelcome, for Germany, since it came under the sway of moral and political degeneration, has provided quite as much musical guano as civilized soil could bear. We do not refer particularly to the pianoforte solos composed and played by Mr. Prokofiev, for they, we are sure, invite their own damnation, because there is nothing in them to hold attention. They pursue no aesthetic purpose, strive for no recognizable ideal, proclaim no means for increasing the expressive potency of music. They are simply perverse. They die the death of abortions.
Now, Now, critics don't write such that they are very careful. As a matter of fact, one of the critics said, I'd better not try to say what I wanted to say about this particular composer, I mean a very new composer, because I'm afraid he will land in Slonimsky's book on Lexicon of Musical Invective. And this is exactly what happened, you know.
The Lexicon has been in print now for over 40 years. Its appeal for both musicians and non-musicians probably stems from our collective need to vindicate overly opinionated critics. Years later, the book's title became the punchline for a joke that involved the kind of wordplay that Nicholas is so fond of. David Raxon.
About a year ago, he had sort of run out of things to do. All he had left to do at the time were a few introductions to some of the books which were being issued in new editions and things like that. And he was wondering what could be his next move. And I said, Nikolai, why don't you think seriously about being another book of anecdotes? And this one would be for people who read Hebrew, which is backwards, you know, from right to left. And he said, really, why would I do that? I said, because you could call it a dyslexicon, a musical invective, you know. Now he cherishes that.
While doing his musical research, Nicholas began to discover discrepancies that would lead him down the path to his next major career, lexicography.
There are so many things that I found out by reading other books, and I did discover a number of errors in sanctified, to use this word, encyclopedias. One says everything is all right, but I found that everything was not all right. And then I said, well, I've got to do something about it.
Nicholas always had a love for research and history. This type of work allowed him to steer clear of things that had tripped him up in the past, such as personal politics and the whimsy of critics and audiences. Throughout the years, he had worked on Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians and other publications. Now, he would become the editor-in-chief of the fifth edition of Baker's Biographical Dictionary of Musicians, published in 1958.
I got a lot of collection of birth certificates. I mean, this was something that nobody even thought of, that I wanted to find out when on any particular date a certain musician was born and when he died, because most dictionaries just gave an approximate date. And so people began to feel that I have something there, that I could at least establish correct dates and analyze works and so on and so forth. And so I became interested in it.
With this publication, Nicholas became known for his scrupulous attention to detail and facts. One peer actually called him that lexicographic beagle of keen scent and sight. Once again, Nicholas had taken an innovative approach to his work, this time with musical biographic research.
One thing that Smolimsky does with the more important composers is something that you find actually rather rarely in reference works, which try to be totally objective. He usually applies an adjective in the very first sentence to describe the composer.
Stephen Ledbetter is musicologist and program annotator for the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Eminent composer, important composer, or in the case of Beethoven, for example, the great German composer whose unsurpassed genius, expressed with supreme mastery in his symphonies, chamber music, concertos, and piano sonatas, revealing an extraordinary power of invention, marked a historic turn in the art of composition. That's as lavish as he ever gets, of course. That's quite remarkable. But let me just sort of look at random and try to find another one of a Edward Hanslick, the critic who is notorious for having attacked Wagner and supported Brahms, greatly renowned Austrian music critic of Czech descent. Howard Hansen, important American composer. I'm just sort of flipping at random to come up with those, but he's willing to go out on the line and express what's really a personal opinion right in the first sentence of a reference work. And that's something that scholars in general tend not to want to do. And a vigor in the writing that is so rare in the normal gray prose of reference works. It gives a real color to it.
Now in its eighth edition, Slonimsky's work in Baker's Dictionary is keenly researched and timelessly informative, with entries from Michelle to Madonna. In his undying pursuit of knowledge, Nicholas has stayed young and vibrant even at 100. If his taste in music seems extraordinarily broad, perhaps it's because his definition of it is really quite simple.
It is not important to be the newest or is the most advanced or the most complicated music. It just has to be the kind of music that is understandable to people of different generations and that inspires composers to write something in a different way. And this is what I believe was my contribution, if there was a contribution.
Always the reluctant genius, or not-so-failed wunderkind, Nicholas Slonimsky seemed to me a gentleman with an inordinately kind heart. He's contributed a wealth to this century's musical history. His 100th birthday was celebrated by his many friends and admirers on April 27, 1994. Truly an original who lived his life on his own terms, he often refuted praise and always went his own way. Happy 100th birthday to a man who will always be an inspiration. You have been listening to Nicholas Slonimsky, a musician of many faces. Producer, Michelle Sweet. Editor, Connie Blazek. Mix engineer, Jane E. Pippick. Additional engineering, Alan Mattis and Fernando Ruiz. A Happy Farmer from Nicholas Slonimsky's Studies in Black and White, and scales from The Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns were performed by Virginia Eskin. A Day for Plorident from Slonimsky's Five Advertising Songs was performed by soprano Delta Eamon and pianist Nicholas Slonimsky. Excerpts from the Lexicon of Musical Invective, courtesy of Schirmer Books, an imprint of Macmillan Publishing Company, were read by Richard Knisley. Excerpts from Perfect Pitch by Nicholas Slonimsky, used with permission of the publisher, Oxford University Press Incorporated, were read by Boris Levitin. Thanks go to Virginia Eskin, Leonard Slatkin, Stephen Ledbetter, Lance Bowling, and Karen Murphy for their involvement in this project, with special thanks to Judith Tick, who first introduced me to the work of Nicholas Slonimsky. I'm your host, Michelle Sweet. Thank you for listening.
I'm your host, Michelle Sweet.
I just can't. Oh, God. I sounded so funny back then. I really was trying. Man, I do have to hand it to my little 26-year-old self. Not too shabby, little Michelle. Along with thanking all those people who lent so much help in the telling of this story. Yes, there are things I would do differently now, but I still love hearing all of Nicholas's stories, especially those clips that I had from his younger years. I have no idea how or where I came across those. Does that ever happen to you? A big blank spot in your memory where there is evidence clearly that, yes, you were there and involved and participating, maybe even driving a thing? But I loved hearing the differences in Nicholas's voice from his 99-year-old self to his younger days, talking about those really old ladies, and they were really old. You know, some of them were born in 18, whenever it was, who didn't like listening to all the modern music. His voice is just marvelous. It's actually a little like those famous Madeleines of Proust, who I have not ever read, but the idea that that taste opened up a space in our memory for all these moments. And for me, that does happen with sonorities. Another thing that stuck out were inflections in my read of that script that I didn't like then and still don't like now. That part when I was saying about Koussevitzky meeting Slonimsky in Paris, and I read the line, "It was there that he offered Nicholas a job." The rhythm of that is all wrong. It actually felt wrong then. It still bugs me to this day. I also hear an edit that I know I struggled with, and that was the slight little hesitation when I said about one of the challenges Koussevitzky undertook deciphering Stravinsky's score to the Rite of Spring. It had this kind of hesitation on the word score, and I remember trying to fix it with an edit, and I still hear it, and it still bugs me.
Was deciphering Stravinsky's score to the Rite of Spring. Stravinsky's score, Stravinsky's score, Stravinsky's score.
Hear what I'm talking about? You know, of course I think I should have asked for another retake on it, but back then that involved booking a studio, getting it together, the piece was already put together on a reel-to-reel. It was so much more involved than it is today when I sit here in my little office and can jump on my own microphone. Another thing about Nicholas is I can hear the difference from the two different days of recordings we did from one day to the next. His voice one time was a little more in his chest and another section where he was up in his head. The different placements of the voice jump out to me. And when you edit them together, I go, oh, I don't know if anybody else, do you notice that? But some of the things that I just can't get enough of were like when he was describing how Koussevitzky would conduct. Koussevitzky would conduct with his Luftpause. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Ooh! I can't. I'm sorry. That is like just one of the best things, hearing his command over the technique and art of conducting. You just hear that utter confidence and competence in his voice. To that end, I think of Nicholas's voice as standing right on a threshold between the cadence, or a word pops up in my head, the prosody of speech and music itself. It's right on the edge of when something goes from expressive to actually being sung. And why do I love this so much? I don't know. I just do. So, no, to answer an earlier question that I asked before playing that show, it wasn't the talk side of radio that set my ear to cadences. It was the slow process of transcribing and listening and editing and working with this sound over and over and over. And again, with so many voices through my whole career that has given me such a strong sense for the cadences of our speech. One more person who did not get mentioned in remembering all about this Nicholas Slonimsky show was actually the producer for that other show, Chamberworks, that I worked for as an intern. Joel Gordon, such a great producer who opened up so many doors for me, a really talented curator for the musicians and ensembles who got invited in to perform on the air, who really welcomed me to come along on remote recordings. And I got to sit backstage in concert halls all over Boston and Cambridge. If you ask me, the best possible way to ever listen to live music, behind the scenes, a casual guy with a keen ear and musical sensibility and a great sense of humor. Thank you, Joel. All right, well, that is well enough of this little trip down memory lane, a reminder of my own roots for doing this work that I do today, audiobooks. Who could have guessed? But I will have more for you on that in the future, sharing voices of some of the writers who have recorded their thumbprint cadences in the form of their self-narrated audiobooks. Here's just one little teaser for you.
I have to go to the bathroom, My notes become higher, the words faster, as no one responds. I have to go to the bathroom. My voice is shrill, hoping someone saves me.
Good God, if you have made it this deep into this episode, you probably should immediately click on the link in the show notes that will take you to my website, michellerado.com, where you can sign up for my monthly newsletter called The Redo. And I certainly hope you have also hit follow on whatever podcast app you happen to be using so that you can automatically get these episodes coming into your podcast queue each month when I post them as well. This show has kind of been a huge long list of thank yous to people from my professional life, but as always, a giant thank you to my dear musician husband, Phil Rado, for the theme music I use on this podcast, who is also freshly back from playing a show at the Bitter End in New York City, his hometown. He was part of a songwriter showcase there and was the lead-off performer for the whole night. It was fantastic. Oh, I'm so proud of him. I just can't help but say that. I think I'll leave you today with the song that he played there called Days. I think I've used it before, but it's one of my favorites, and it feels like it's appropriate for almost anything. But my biggest thanks are to you, my dear listener, for making it all the way to the bitter end of this very indulgent episode and for giving me the most precious gift any one of us have to give, and that is our time. So until next month, keep listening.
Change. Days turn into other days, turn into different days with the rhythm of another place. You try to earn your wings and you embrace the ancient things. The days they don't remain, they will change. And I'm well on my way, I'm well down the road to where I was before I was born. And it's not the end, and it brings me peace, it gives me hope, and I'll just start again. And life is out for blood when the blood still runs, and we cry. It'll change. Days turn into other days. They turn into different days with the rhythm of the falling rain. We're treading water, and we're running in place. We're trying to do the same old thing, but the days, they'll change. When the blood still runs, and we cry when the well runs dry. Faces change, and days turn into other days. They turn into different days with the rhythm of another place. And we are dancing, we are living, and throughout our days, change.